Love Sport Radio. On digital radio, online, mobile and smart speaker. This is the James Gray Show with the Lords Taverners.
You're listening to a podcast edition of The James Gray Show. You can listen to me live every weekday from 1:30 p.m. on Love Sport Radio, on DAB Digital, online or on your Alexa smart speaker. And if you're listening to the podcast, do leave us a rating and a review on iTunes, Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Love Sport.
Of course, last night, a captain did step up in England's time of need, but failed. Steph Houghton took the penalty taking responsibilities away from Nikita Paris, who had missed her last two, and she stepped up and said, "I'm the captain, I'll take this penalty," to equalise in the late stages of the semi-final against USA. We all know, and as English football fans, we kind of almost expected what happened next, because she missed that penalty. You still have to give her some credit. You still have to give Steph Houghton some credit. I'm not saying all the credit, because obviously she missed, but you still have to give her some credit for the fact that she said, "I'll take this penalty. This is a pressure situation, and I'm the England captain, and I will step up and take this penalty." Because for Nikita Paris, it would have been a nightmare situation for her. Penalty taking is so much about confidence. You know, it's not actually that difficult a skill. You should almost always score. It's why people celebrate when they win them. It's why England celebrated when VAR awarded it. So it's not that difficult a skill, but it is a nerve-wracking one. And you've got to be able to compartmentalise, to control your nerves. And that's what Steph Houghton felt she could do. The sad thing is for her that she didn't. And it was a dreadful penalty. It was a really poor penalty. I'm not going to get away from that. But in terms of leadership and in terms of what Steph Houghton has brought to that team, it was actually really interesting. I recently watched a game Man City played where Steph was mic'd up. So you could hear every single word that she was saying throughout the game. And I've never heard someone talk as much as she did in that game. Constantly talking to her players, to the referee, to her manager. Constantly encouraging, but also organising. And obviously, as a centre-half, you have to do that. But she's such a good leader and such an important part of that England team. And I think that is a crucial part of what she did last night. I know she wasn't perfect. And I know she might never be perfect, but and she'll never be able to get that penalty back, crucially. And look, England might have lost in extra time, or heaven forbid, on penalties anyway. So it might not have mattered. But that will live with her, and she won't forget that. And England won't forget that. The one thing I think that will happen is the team won't blame her. She is so respected in that dressing room. And throughout English football, to be fair, because of what she's achieved at Arsenal, what she's achieved at City, what she's achieved with England and indeed in the Olympics, that she will not be blamed for what she's done. Phil Neville, incidentally, he might pick up some of the blame. He shouldn't have played 4-4-2. It's as simple as that, isn't it? I was, you know, when the team sheet came out, I was still here in the office helping out a few bits and pieces, and Drive Time producer said, "Well, what's the team?" So I took it in and he said, "Well, how do they line up?" And I went, "Well, I haven't really worked it out yet. It's just in a list because they just published it in a straight list." And there was no Karen Bardsley. Fine. Oh, no, Karen Bardsley injured. Gutted all. Carly Telford's very capable. Chelsea goalkeeper. Good with her feet. Great. Okay. And then he went, "Well, where's Frank Kirby? Where's Tony Duggan?" Oh, all right. And I sort of thought they might go 4-3-3 and maybe play Rachel Daly in midfield, but that didn't really make sense. And they went 4-4-2. And everyone thought, actually, they might either go 4-3-3 or 4-2-3-1. Either way, they're expecting Ellen White up front on her own, as she has done all tournament, and very effectively too. And it wasn't the case. They went 4-4-2. And I'm yet to see an analysis that correctly points out to me why that was the right decision. Because you know what you're going to get from the US, right? This US team, they're very physical. They're very high intensity, especially early on. And they like to sort of kill games early. And England must have known, because they've played them twice in the last, 18 months, and got very close on both occasions, England must have known that they would probably do that in the early stages. So for me, to play two in the centre of midfield, in Kira Walsh and Jill Scott, is naive. Because what you're saying is, right, as a striker, you can close down a centre-half straight at them. And all you have to do is run in between the centre-half and the central midfielder. You simultaneously close the ball down and block off a passing lane. If you play three in midfield, as they have done all tournament pretty much, you're able to have more midfielders coming and offering a pass for the centre-halves. And as good as Steph Houghton and Millie Bright are, although Millie's not had a great tournament, let's be honest, as good as they are, they can't pass their way through treacle. And America pressed like treacle. That's how thick it was to get through. And England do play through the lines. But when you switch to 4-4-2, and when you switch from that system that you've played all tournament, you have to be more direct. That's the way that system works. 4-4-2 is a traditional one, and the way you play it is you essentially play channels, and one striker runs and the other feeds off the scraps. So you can't then play that low intensity. Well, it is low intensity, frankly, sometimes, but you can't then play that short passing game. And they look so tactically naive. And I don't know whether that came from Neville, whether that was the women on the pitch not adapting. I don't know. But either way, it wasn't the right decision. And I think Phil Neville actually should take a little bit of responsibility here. Now, I also know that managers are loath to do it because you essentially write your own obituary if you admit to making a mistake, especially in a major tournament semi-final. But he did. And maybe further on down the line, he'll realise that he did. Just as Gareth Southgate realised that he made a mistake against Croatia by failing to adapt from the rigid system that he felt. I wonder if, to a certain extent, it was change for change's sake in Phil Neville's case. He knew he had to change things because he was coming up against a far, far better side than Norway in the US. He felt he had to make some changes just to try and upset them. But actually, it was the US who made the crucial changes. They dropped Megan Rapinoe. They picked Christian Press, who, as her name suggests, presses extremely well. And she effectively marked Lucy Bronze out of the game. You know, Lucy did not have her best game by any stretch of the imagination. And Christian Press can say, well, I did the job. She also scored, obviously. But quite apart from that, she also played an excellent role defensively. And England were hamstrung by that. So there are a lot of mistakes to pick out last night. I suppose if we're looking for positives, and we should, is that we've all got behind the Lionesses. The country have enjoyed watching women's football. And I think a lot of people have been surprised by women's football, surprised by the quality on show. And I hope that this translates, when the WSL kicks off again, that this translates into people going out and supporting and watching those teams, because they deserve it.
Love Sport.
Let's talk a little bit more about that semi-final defeat for England last night, because we've got Molly Hudson, women's football reporter for The Times, on the line. Molly, disappointment, I'm sure, but it was a spectacle, wasn't it? And I think probably the right team won on the night.
I think that's a pretty good way of summing it up. It did feel as though the Americans were so good, and we knew that going into the game. England knew what they were coming up against. They were coming up against the world champions, Olympic champions in the past, the best team in the world. And I think, you know, what made it so painful and so hard, particularly in the stadium last night, was England came so close. Maybe they didn't deserve to, almost, but with the way Ellen White just was so clinical with their finishing, she gave England hope. And then to have that penalty and the drama, and for the captain, Steph Houghton, to step up and take that, and then to miss it was just the worst feeling, because it was that lingering sense of what could have been, and what, not only what could have been in that game, but what it could have meant for the sport as a whole.
Were you surprised when you saw Steph step up to take the penalty?
I was, and that was purely because Phil Neville had spoken to him so much in the lead up to this about backing Nikita Paris. Obviously, she's had penalty saved against Argentina and against Norway. And a lot of the time, she's taken penalties for Manchester City. And she's a very good penalty taker. You know, she's dealt with pressure before. Of course, she's a young player and she's not as experienced as Steph. But Phil had said, look, I'm going to stand by her. She is my best penalty taker. So to look up and see Steph approaching the penalty, you know, we all sort of wondered how it came to that conclusion, whether it had been done on the field. Was it just, you know, this is the biggest moment and this is your captain that makes this decision. And in the end, we found out that it was something that Phil had decided based on the fact that Steph was the second best penalty taker on the pitch and that she hadn't missed in the tournament, which still I don't quite understand the logic, but it's such a big turning point, and I think it's a shame that for everything that Steph has done in this tournament, she's been incredible, she's been a leader, she's been the best, probably the best defender as well, that she'll be remembered for that penalty miss.
It does seem unfair. I wonder if Phil Neville might be remembered as the man who said his style is non-negotiable and then played 4-4-2 in the semi-final. I cannot make head nor tail of why he decided to do that, Molly. Shed any light on it for us?
Absolutely not. We just, you know what, we sat in the press box when the team come out and we thought we'd heard rumours of, you know, potentially he's going to change it up. Which, you know, people were saying you'll never guess this team in your wildest dreams. And you thought it was odd, and then you play it. It started off, and the US did their power play as they always do at the beginning. It came firing out of the box and just threw everything at us. And you just wondered, you know, if he was ever going to change formation. You change to a three. You don't change to another formation that leaves you with your two in midfield that have been so vulnerable against the very best. And I think what told more than anything was probably that when Phil did change it up, changed it up in the second half, and he went back to the 4-2-3-1 that has served him so well, we actually looked a better side, and I think there was a bit more of a structure there. So I think it was a gamble, and you know, I'm sure if we were sat here this afternoon saying that we'd beaten the world champions, we'd be looking at Phil as if he was a genius. And I suppose that, you know, as we've said so much during this tournament, the lines between genius and insanity are so thin. And I think looking back on it now with hindsight, he would never do that, I don't think. But, you know, for him, he must have felt that the only way to attack the US was to fight fire with fire.
Did he have an explanation for it afterwards? Did you hear much from him to suggest that this was a master plan with some method to the madness?
Do you know what it is? I think he was so proud of his players, and he was so proud of what they achieved and probably how close they actually got. I mean, he talked a lot in the build-up about the fact that if we didn't win this was a failure. But at the end, he sort of changed his mind and said, actually, this isn't a failure because these players they've played with their hearts and they've given everything and they've made a nation proud. And I think regardless of the way he set up, you know, that was ifs and buts, and I don't think he was ever going to sort of admit that he was wrong, which perhaps with hindsight he probably was, and he probably thinks he is now looking back at it. I think the most important thing was that legacy and whether or not that can continue and grow.
Molly, I know you've obviously been out in France covering the game, but I wonder what you think this World Cup will have done for women's football back in England. You know, once we get back to, well, humdrum seems an unfair word, but that's what it is. You know, the regulation of the season. Do you think we will see an upsurge in attendances and crucially, of course, participation?
I think it's hard to tell. I think particularly the FA have done really well with the grassroots levels, and that's not just during this tournament, it's been before. It's been an ongoing process, making sure that young girls have that pathway to get into the game. They can play football at school. And that's something that the US have done so well, and that probably was displayed on the biggest stage last night, that just the strength and depth that they have that England don't have to choose from at the moment. But I think Phil and the FA and everyone have worked so hard for this moment, and it did feel like a sort of like a balloon deflating when you saw the players drop to their knees and you just thought, is this the end? We're building and building and building. You're waiting for that moment where it really does translate into the league and it translates into attendances and footfall and, at the end of the day, finances, because that's how every sport is eventually successful. And I think it's so, so important that we do capitalise on that. I don't think there's an easy answer as to how to do that, but the first round of Women's Super League fixtures is the Manchester Derby. You know, Manchester United v Manchester City, a whole host of lionesses on show. And if that doesn't get people out and watching, then I don't know what will.
Well, Molly, thank you very much for coming. We've certainly been out and watching and desperately gutted last night when they lost 2-1.
Love Sport.
Forget Rafa Nadal. We're doing Rafael Benitez. Ambition, potential, trust, power and control. All words that came out of Rafa's mouth when he was trying to describe his departure from Newcastle United. Of course, he joined the club back in March 2016. They were doomed for relegation. and now he's finally departed this week. He did an interview with George Culkin of the Times, an excellent reporter on Newcastle, talking all about exactly how things had gone down. And it describes, and the article that is, George describes the initial relationship between Rafa and Newcastle as what Rafa wants, Rafa gets. Benitez was named manager, not head coach. It's a rare titular, but actually what turned to be an ultimately symbolic gesture, I'm afraid to say. And it was kind of typical of Rafa that he didn't really dish the dirt on everything that gone on. I don't know, maybe he signed an NDA. That's not uncommon. But given that he wasn't sacked, given that his contract just expired, he's pretty much free to say what he likes, as far as I'm concerned. But what he did say was that it was almost immediately obvious to him, and he didn't quite say it in as many words, but you can infer it pretty easily. It was almost immediately obvious to him that all of the things that he had been told were not going to transpire. Everything that he had been told about who would be in control of transfers, how much money there was available, how they could get business done, all of that just wasn't going to happen. And I give him credit for being as diplomatic as he was, because that must have been intensely frustrating. He said, talking about the transfer market, you have to move to quickly get your first and second choices. Sometimes we weren't doing that, and it got worse and worse. I mean, that's the understatement of the century. Sometimes we weren't doing that. They never seemed to get the men they wanted. They always seemed to get their second, third, or even fourth choices. And it's not a sustainable way to run a football club. So Rafa would necessarily be free to criticise his former employers. But equally, and this is kind of where you end up being with it, he did get 20 million quid's worth of salary out of them, you know, over those 3 years. He was well rewarded for what he did. But even with that money in his pocket, even with that salary, you know, to a man who could go and earn the same money somewhere else, of course, he did well to last 3 years, frankly. Can you imagine being someone like Rafa Benitez, who has spent his career accumulating trophies, managing some of the biggest clubs in European football, Real Madrid, Liverpool, Napoli, big Chelsea for that matter, big jobs as a manager, to then go to Newcastle and have a guy like Mike Ashley and a bloke like Lee Charnley basically just run around you and sort of dangle things and go, ha, 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 you don't get this. We said we were going to give you this. We're not going to now. Can you imagine how daily humiliating that must be? He said he couldn't take just sitting there hanging on for draws when he wanted this club to first challenge for top 10, then top 8, then Europe. That was his ambition for the club. And he didn't want to sit there and watch this team that has so many thousands and worldwide millions of people cheering it on just fail to do that. It was a frustration that he didn't feel he could tolerate, because every transfer window, it was smoke and mirrors. It was exhausting for him. They weren't getting the ones they wanted. They weren't even getting their second choices. It was fourth choices they were having to deal with, and it must have been intensely frustrating, and eventually Benitez, his patience ran out. So now he's off to China, and credit to him, he's already landed out there. Newcastle fans pining for his return, I'm sure, but there are 12 million reasons why that won't be happening. And I'm sure he doesn't really want to go to China, though. For all the money, you know, and I always say this, I always say if I offered to double or triple your salary, you'd go anywhere. And I would. And I would go to China to double my salary from a job that I wasn't happy in. But I wouldn't be happy about it. I wouldn't want to do it. It'd be something that I was doing to make my life easier in the future, to make my life more comfortable, to support my kids, my family. So I'm sure he doesn't want to go there. His family live in Liverpool. At least when he was at Newcastle, it was just a drive over the Pennines and a few other mountain ranges, I'm sure. My geography in that part of the world's not good. Anyway, what I do know is it's a lot further from Liverpool to Shanghai than it is from Liverpool to Newcastle. Although the cultural divide, you might claim, is pretty similar. It's not easy. It's not going to be easy for him walking away from that. I'm sure he'd much rather have stayed in Europe and, you know, taken a job at the likes of Juventus or PSG, Arsenal even. But to do that, And this is kind of where my point comes. To do that, I think he would have had to jump ship earlier. He would have had to say, you know what, Newcastle? I've been here 2 years. I got you out of the Championship at the first time of asking. I've kept you comfortably in the Premier League. You've still not given me any money. That's that. See you later. Don't fancy it. And I don't know why anyone would now go and take that Newcastle job. We spoke earlier this week to Chris Waugh, a writer at the Chronicle, big old historical paper in Newcastle. And he said, he was saying how much, even if Ashley stays at the club, because remember there is a takeover possibly happening or not. So even if Ashley stays at the club, it will still remain an attractive opportunity for a manager.
Particularly European managers who are looking for a first opportunity in the Premier League, this could be the chance for them whereby a lot of structures that you get on the continent, you don't necessarily have the final say on transfers, so working within that sort of remit is not necessarily alien to them. There's also a lot of out-of-work managers in England at the moment, or those in the lower leagues who are ambitious and want an opportunity. And at the end of the day, yes, you're working with a Mike Ashley who's far from the ideal owner, but at the same time, Newcastle United remain a massive football club. They're a Premier League football club. And if Newcastle United come calling, a lot of people will feel that they can't turn that down as long as they're given assurances to a degree. I don't think that any of them will be afforded anywhere near the power Benitez was, but as long as they're given some autonomy to a degree and are given the chance to take Newcastle forward, there will be a lot of interest in it. And there already has been. I know for a fact that plenty of managers have already applied.
Plenty of Newcastle fans will hope that those managers are queuing up, that they are top-level managers, that they are people who are able to take the club back to that level. But not only, you know, if you're going to take the Newcastle job, you're going to have to sort of kid yourself about exactly what you're doing. You're going to have to ever so slightly lie to yourself about what you're taking on. When a manager, when Mike Ashley says to you, we'll do this, this and this, you have to take into context that he probably said all of that to Benitez as well, and none of it happened. But Benitez couldn't drag himself away because it was heart-ruling head. He knew all the trust, and that word, of those words he mentioned, ambition, potential, power, control, trust, I think is the most important one. And even though he knew the trust between himself and the owner had broken down, because he was no longer able to believe what the owner said, those 50,000 Geordies every other week kept pulling him back. All that support from the Newcastle fans just kept pulling him back. He couldn't tear himself away from it. He did what all football fans do, which is hope. He hoped things would get better. And it's a mistake I think Frank Lampard's about to make. If he takes the Chelsea job, we understand he will in the next 24 or 36 hours, although that's been said a few times in the last week or so. But either way, we think he's going to get the job sooner rather than later. And we think he's on the brink of it, a job that he's dreamed of his whole life. And it must be extremely hard to try and turn down that sort of thing. I don't know. I've never quite been offered my dream job. Not that this isn't my dream job. This is lovely, obviously. But, you know, if Liverpool wants to make me their manager, like, I don't know what it's like to try and turn that down. But again, if he does, it's his head being ruled by his heart. Because he's only got 1 year of managerial experience. The club have got a two-window transfer ban. Roman Abramovich can't decide if he still wants to be the owner. The best player's just left and there's no chance to replace him. They don't have a centre-forward. There could not be a worse time to take the Chelsea job. And yet, Lampard has gone onto Abramovich's yacht, presumably been spun a lovely yarn about how much Abramovich respects him. And he probably didn't need that much convincing because it's Chelsea and he's got blue-tinted glasses on. He'll have been promised the world and the world's not there. Ole Gunnar Solskjaer couldn't have taken the United job at a worse time. Realistically, Zinedine Zidane said he was done and dusted with Madrid and then went back with the club in disarray because his heart ruled his head. Alan Shearer back at Newcastle, Brian Gunn back at Norwich. Don't make these mistakes of letting your heart rule your head, because you absolutely have to find a way to make the right decisions at the right time. And that's, I think, partly on Rafa. Sure, he was treated badly by the club, but he can't let that detract from the fact that he could have left earlier. He probably should have left earlier. Don't stay in those relationships. They're not good for you.
Love Sport.
Now, anyone who listens to the show regularly will know that boxing is a big part of my world and a big, well, I wouldn't say hobby because, frankly, I wouldn't want to get in the ring. And I wouldn't want to get in the ring with our next guest. Tunde Ajayi is on the line. He's a trainer of Anthony Yard, who, of course, is, we think, set to take on Sergei Kovalev in August or September. I don't know. Tunde, there seems to be a lot of uncertainty around this fight the last couple of days. Is there any uncertainty in your mind that things might change?
I wouldn't call it uncertainty. You know, there's not been a few names, but there's been one particular name that's been thrown in the hat in the last week or so, and that's Canelo Alvarez. So it's all getting exciting. it's all exciting, but the fact of the matter is this: we are number one WBO mandated, and you know, though there's only so much I can say on this matter contractually, you know, the buck stops with us. So, you know, everything has to go through us. If we are to step aside or if this fight, but you know, we have a date, we have a venue, and yeah, it's business as usual for me and Anthony. We're just continuing to train and you know, master our craft, and when it happens, it happens.
Is there an element of that when you got this stuff? Because, you know, we know that Canelo Alvarez has sort of thrown this offer in there. Frank was talking about it, saying he can understand why the Kovalev camp are considering it because of the payday. Is it quite hard for the two of you, and especially for Anthony, because in the end he's the athlete here, is it quite hard to kind
of
block...
I'm the teacher.
Yeah. And your job is to block that out, is it?
Anything Anthony throws, I feel.
But how important is it for you as a team to kind of try and block that stuff out, or do you just absorb it and kind of...
Well, it's one of the reasons why I, you know, developed and had a or work under an ethic of professionalism. And that is, and by that I mean that regardless of date, the whole objective of boxing is to master the craft. And everybody I've ever trained has been trained under that manner. And so for me and Anthony, we never focus on the date. We never focus on the opponent, although there's always a date and there is always an opponent. But we're just obsessed with progression. And having that mindset, nothing outside of the gym ever bothers us. It's part of the business. It has to be done. There's contracts to be signed. There's venues to be secured. And that's the side of boxing which really we have no control over. So we just have to deal and focus on the things we do have control over, and that's perfecting our craft. So Andy's not bothered. I'm not bothered. We're like, when we get the date, when we get the venue, it's turn up, show up, blow up, lions in the camp.
you make it all sound so easy. Look, it's not going to be that easy, realistically, because Sergei Kovalev is a really experienced guy.
Who said it's not going to be easy? Said it's not going to be easy.
Yeah.
I've said this is going to be another day in the office. I've said this from the beginning of Anthony's career. I said the world will see that Anthony Yard is a special athlete. I'm a special teacher, and the two of us together are going to create history in the sport. And we're going to make it look easy, but boxing is not an easy sport. It's a sport that takes maximum focus and concentration and application to your craft. And so, although we may make it look easy, it's not easy, but it's going to be easy when we get in the ring.
All right, I'll take your word for it. You mentioned that right from the beginning you said that with Anthony. Tell me about your relationship with him, maybe the first time you met him, and what sort of marked him out as someone who could go far.
Well, it's funny, because I'm, for want of a better word, stuck up my own ass.
All right.
I'm always like, I'm the teacher. You don't go to Cambridge University expecting the student to teach Cambridge University. They set the syllabus and you study hard to master the syllabus and get your grades. So I'm like, I don't look at no fighters. I'm not, you know, I haven't ever had a mindset of, oh yeah, look at this great fighter I'm about to train. I'm like, I've developed a unique system, which I've said from the start is going to revolutionize the sport, and the boxers have to come under that system. Bring the natural talent, the genetic talent which they have, couple it with my system, and we can do big things. So when Anthony actually came to me, or was brought to me by a great friend of mine, Jolene Curley, who was an athlete, you know, she said to me that this kid has got something. So Anthony came to the gym. I said to Anthony, what have you won? He said, nothing. I said, well, go back and win something. So that's what he done. He entered the Haringey Box Cup. He knocked out every single opponent in the competition, brought back the winning trophy, said, there you are, Mr. Jay. I said, all right, let's start training. And that's how me and Anthony met. And from that day, we've been inseparable. We've trained every day, you know, well, 6 days a week. And in less than 4 years, we've created, or we've done something that I don't think has ever been done. You know, when have you ever seen a 12-fight amateur? An amateur, a novice amateur, let's get that right. It wasn't a national ABA title. It was a novice championship that he won. You know, win a Southern Area in 10 fights, a European WBO, an intercontinental European belt, and be ranked number one in the world, about to knock off the recognized number one WBO champion, a man who beat Bernard Hopkins. And a great champion. But, you know, everything is timing, as I've always said, and it's our time. But this has never been done.
I watched a fascinating interview with Anthony this morning with BT when someone asked him about whether he's worried about controversial scorecards in Russia, and he didn't even get to finish the question. He just said KO. Is that something as a trainer? I mean, because I sometimes think the perfect boxing performance, or some people will say the perfect boxing performance, is 12 rounds and you take the cards unanimously. Have you always looked for knockouts?
Rubbish. I've never believed that. I teach every person to have a mindset of a knockout. It's KO. And Anthony has the same mindset. You know, I don't teach people to go points. People always say, and when I came into the sport of boxing, people say, you know, don't look for the knockout. I told them, go and look for the knockout. Listen, you don't go into the hairdressers and you hear people talking about that great points victory from last night's boxing. They don't. They start saying, why didn't you knock him out with the right uppercut or the left uppercut? That's all they're interested in. That's all the fans are interested in. They're interested in knockouts. And it's because of the knockout, we all remember who Mike Tyson was.
Yeah.
You know, Mike Tyson, he brought that energy and that spectacle to boxing. And Anthony Yard has done the same thing. 18 fights, 17 KOs. Even the one that lasted early in his career is because he knocked the guy down in the second round and he broke his hand. So that was good, you know, mental testing for Anthony very early in his career, because he came back to the corner and he said, "Unks, I broke my hand." I said, "Well, then use the other hand."
Clever. I mean, again, genius, that. Broken one hand, use the other one. I just want to, while I've got you, Tony, I want to pick your brains about something, because as a boxing fan myself, the thing that other people always ask me, especially the last couple of weeks, is about this Anthony Joshua thing. And we talked about knockouts. And I wonder what your view of that defeat for him was. Was it one of those days when he woke up feeling a bit ill and it just happens? Or is this a real chink in his armour?
I mean, it's funny because it's known in boxing I don't watch fighters. I don't watch any modern-day fighters.
Okay.
But Spencer Fury, who I grew up with, has been telling me, "Turn, watch this fight, watch this fight." Knowing full well that I don't watch any boxers. Any current boxer I don't watch. So he told me to watch the Anthony Joshua. And I watched it yesterday. For some reason, I watched the fight. I just, like, it's really out of character for me to watch another fight.
Yeah.
And I watched it. And it looked okay to me. I mean, I was like, because obviously you hear the talk and you hear everyone saying this, that. It just looked to me that it wasn't his night, that he could rectify it in the rematch. But from what I saw, from the technical standpoint I saw, Andy Ruiz fought a perfect fight. He was patient against a guy that he knew can punch, that had range. Every time Anthony Joshua jabbed to the stomach, he parried the jab. He threw a left hook. When Anthony Joshua threw a jab to the head, he parried the jab. This is a guy that knows boxing. And when Adni tried to unload on him, he took the punch and he came back with a flurry. So this is somebody that's obviously, you can't say he's done his homework, because you don't just prepare for a fight over 8 weeks and then it comes out on fight night. No, this is someone that's been boxing and perfecting his craft for a long time. So can he do better in a rematch? I think he can, because he did drop him. He did drop him, but I think that just awoken the lion. I think he just got back up and go, oh, all right, let's go again. You understand? So, Anthony Joshua is someone, even though I haven't watched him up until yesterday, he's someone that I support. He's someone that I think has done great for British boxing. He's actually made the average person on the street pay an interest, if not to boxing, to him. Mm. And if they're paying an interest to him, they're paying an interest to boxing. So he's been great for British boxing. I just think that, I'd never use the word everybody can lose, because I don't even like that word, LOS. My way is everybody can win. But he came up short that night. And let's see a test of his character. Let's see if he can bounce back and, do what he's supposed to do, because he's great for the sport.
Tunde, thank you so much for your time. Absolute pleasure to speak to you as always, and I'm sure we'll see you out in Russia very soon. Tunde Ajayi there, one of the great up-and-coming trainers working with Anthony Yard, who we think, we hope, and almost certainly will be fighting for a world title in Russia next month.
Love Sport.
Now, it's time for you to get another chance to hear our mystery voices. I'm sure I've got one, and I'm sort of vaguely sure I've got two. Remember, they are topical. So they are involved in the sport and they are sporting as well. So three sporty mystery voices for you to try and guess. I've definitely got one of them, struggling for one massively, and then the other one. Go on.
I went to catch the ball.
You win or you lose.
Didn't get back to sleep till 7.
Oh, no. Oh, one more time, Ben. Come on.
I went to catch the ball.
You win or you lose.
Didn't get back to sleep till 7.
Okay, so if you do have any idea of the first one particularly, please drop me a WhatsApp on 0208 7020 558. I really do need your help on this one. The last... you know what the worst thing is, Ben? Usually I get better as you go on. I'm now doubting myself about the third one. Go on, play it one more time.
I went to catch the ball.
You win or you lose.
Didn't get back to sleep till 7.
I'm clueless. I don't know any of them anymore. I thought I had 2 out of 3. Okay, right. Well, I don't know what I'm going to do, Ben. I don't know what I'm going to do. I'm going to need some help, please. 0208 7020 558. 0208 7020 558. Add us as a contact, and then you can drop us a WhatsApp. It's the easiest way to get in touch directly to the studio. A little screen just next to me, and you'll be able to fire the answers onto my screen. I don't know if you've got any correct ones yet. It doesn't look like it, I suspect. Now, it's time for us to do our sort of daily dive into the world of football transfer rumours. Now, top of the list today, and I was surprised to see his name bandied around, although, frankly, why am I ever surprised when it comes to Manchester United? Gareth Bale. This is going to be... I mean, this would be, if it comes off, probably the biggest swap deal I can remember. After, Michael Owen, Antonio Nunez. Yes, no one remembers that Antonio Nunez was the make weight in the Michael Owen to Real Madrid deal. Anyway, there's chat of Real Madrid and Manchester United swapping Gareth Bale for Paul Pogba. This is kind of intriguing, really, because it sort of brings into question who's more valuable. Because Paul Pogba probably is, but he's not necessarily performed at the highest level for a number of years, whereas Gareth Bale at least seems to perform, but he's a little bit older, and that'll probably make the difference. United have apparently valued, and this is according to the Daily Mail today, apparently valued Paul Pogba at £150 million. £150 million, would you believe that? Given what they paid for him, world record fee, 100 million quid and the rest of it, 88.3, is that right? Given what they paid for him, I'm surprised that they're looking to try and make a profit on him. But I suppose, having paid his wages for the last 3 years, you probably think, well, actually, we really need a return on everything here, because what has Paul Pogba given the football club? Overall, what has he won at Manchester United? Really very little indeed. And I think they will look at it and think, not only do we need to get back what we paid for him in the transfer market, but we also need to get back what we paid for him in wages. And they also want to get Gareth Bale. He's been on the list at United. I know Ed Woodward is a massive fan of Gareth Bale. To the extent that he once said to Mourinho, or is supposed to have said to Mourinho, here's your transfer budget for the summer. It's 150 million quid plus whatever you get from selling players. And we're buying Gareth Bale. And Mourinho said, okay, fine, you buy Gareth Bale, but it's not coming out of my budget. So he wanted Woodward to basically give him a player free of charge. Bizarre. Anyway, they now think, and I suspect this is partly coming from Madrid, really, because they do want to offload Bale. He's not featuring in their plans for next season. We understand him and Zidane not always got on. And it's Spanish newspaper Marca that are suggesting that Madrid, it will be, who offer a player plus cash offer for Paul Pogba. Now, they've also talked about Neymar, so it's clear that Real Madrid, and we kind of always known this about Real Madrid, the way the clubs run, they like having a marquee signing, someone who can really give them a boost in terms of their overall profile, because of course their president is elected and he's got to convince fans to re-elect him, so it's difficult to imagine how he might actually be able to, well, make it any worse. But certainly Paul Pogba will be able to make things better. He's understood to be, quote, desperate to move to the Spanish capital this summer, but whether or not Bale's inclusion in a deal changes United's stance is yet to be seen. I would suggest that for United, it's win-win. If Bale's not valued too highly, if they still get, say, 100 million for Paul Pogba and they get Gareth Bale, I think they'll see that as a pretty big win, because they get the PR bounce of getting someone like Gareth Bale back into English football. He's also pretty experienced. You know, they've got a young squad now. They're trying to build a young squad. There's a lot of older players who will almost certainly be moving on this summer. And I think you'll probably see them try and bring in a couple more young players. That said, they will need a little bit of experience, because no young player is ever perfect overnight. And someone like Gareth Bale, a guy who's got a lot of experience, who's played in Champions League finals, scored in Champions League finals, carried the weight of a country on his back at a major tournament, all of those things, I think he will be a very valuable individual for Manchester United if they're able to get a deal done for him. The only concern, I suppose, is that he turns 30 in a couple of weeks, and he's had quite a lot of injuries. He's had a lot of football. You know, we've seen players hit 30 and they're basically done because they've played so much football earlier on in their career. Gareth Bale, at the age of 29, has played 479 club games, plus 77 caps for Wales. So close to 600 games of football since his senior debut way back for Southampton in 2005. That's a lot of football, and that takes a toll on someone. He's also had a lot of injury problems, obviously, but there's also just the wear and tear. You know, yes, he's had this calf issue and this groin issue, but the wear and tear of all those games does take its toll on a footballer. So I think it'll be interesting to see whether Manchester United value him that highly. I suspect they will try and, well, obviously they're going to try and negotiate any sort of valuation down, but I wonder how highly they will value him if they do a deal with Real Madrid to bring Paul Pogba to the Spanish capital and Gareth Bale away from Manchester, and Gareth Bale back to English football, to Manchester United. They're also, we understand, this is the Telegraph story today, being told that they will have to pay more than £90 million for Harry Maguire. It would, of course, make him the most expensive defender of all time if they want to sign the English centre-back this summer. There was a story a couple of weeks ago that Maguire had sort of received interest and offers from United and from City, and that he'd chosen City over United, but then they said, Leicester that is, no, 65 million quid's not enough. And City went, frankly, 65 million quid is more than enough. At any price bigger than that, we're not interested. And now United are going to pay through the nose for him. And honestly, I think they'll probably have to. I think they will find themselves paying for Harry Maguire, paying 90 million quid for Harry Maguire. It's not worth it. It's clearly not worth it. When they could go to Serie A and get someone like Kalidou Koulibaly or Milan Skriniar, and they're probably going to cost him less. They're probably going to cost them 80, 70 million quid as opposed to the 100 that has been mooted. I don't really see those players costing more than 100 million pounds. You know, Kalidou Koulibaly, for example, is probably a better player than Harry Maguire, but he's also not perfect. You know, when you see a guy like him who's been repeatedly linked with the likes of Manchester United, Chelsea, Juventus, Real Madrid even. A player gets repeatedly linked with those but doesn't go. That tells you that every single one of those clubs is going, yeah, he's good and there's this, but just not convinced enough about him. There's always someone who they think might be slightly better. So that's a concern, but it also suggests to me that eventually Napoli, and I know that their owner is famously difficult to negotiate with and famously just says, this is how much he's going for. If you don't pay that, he's not going at all. But nevertheless, I wonder whether eventually they might go, we kind of have to cash in on this guy now because he's not getting any younger and realistically the bids are so big. So I'll be fascinated to see who Manchester United bring in at centre-half this summer.
This is Love Sport.
You've been listening to a podcast edition of The James Gray Show. Remember to leave us a rating and a review, but only nice ones. I don't take criticism well.